Mark chapter 15. This afternoon we're going to look at verses 1 through 15. And we're also going to try to fill in some of the gaps. As far as the Gospels go, Mark gives us the least amount of information whenever it comes to covering this section of Scripture. He really gives the bare bones as he goes through here. So I want to read Mark, and then I also want to supplement that with Luke and with John as we go back through and kind of fill in the gaps. So let's start in verse 1 of Mark chapter 15. It says, "And straightway in the morning the chief priest held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him to Pilate." Let me stop for a second and just remind you where we are. Before this section in Mark chapter 14, they had taken Jesus, the Jews had taken Jesus, and they had put him on trial. Mark 15 begins with the last part of that. There were really three sections of that trial. When they got Jesus, they took him to Annas. We read about that in John. Annas was was Caiaphas, who was the high priest. Annas was his father-in-law. And if you remember, when we described that, Annas was kind of like the mafia boss of the whole religious leaders of Israel. He was the head guy. There were, you know, Caiaphas was the mouthpiece, but Annas kind of pulled the strings. So he went to Annas, and that didn't work out very well. And so then he goes, and they have this trial at night to condemn Jesus. And according to their customs, their traditions, and their laws, that was illegal to condemn anyone at night. So when we start in Mark chapter 15, we get the third part of that, and that is after they had gotten their verdict that night, they reassembled in the morning, is what Mark tells us here. And as they did that just as a formality so that they could say that they had condemned Christ during the day. So that's where we start. We're going from the Jewish trial over to Pilate and the trial that will take place with Pilate. And just to kind of give you an easy way to think through that, Pilate's trial is split up into three different sections as well. The Jews will take him to Pilate. Pilate will send him to Herod. And then Herod will send him back to Pilate. And so as you think about this and try to keep the information straight in your head, those three parts of the trial can be helpful. The Jews take him to Pilate. Pilate sends him to Herod. Herod sends him back to Pilate. So let's keep reading in Mark 15, starting in verse 2. It says, "And Pilate asked him, 'Art thou the king of the Jews?' And he answered and he said unto him, 'Thou sayest it.' And the chief priest accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. And Pilate asked him again, saying, 'Answerest thou nothing? Behold, how many things they witness against thee.' But Jesus yet answered nothing, so that Pilate marveled. Now at the feast he released unto them one prisoner, whomsoever they desired. And there was one named Barabbas, which lay bound with them that had made insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection. And the multitude, crying aloud, began to desire him to do as he had ever done unto them. But Pilate answered them, saying, 'Will ye that I release unto you the king of the Jews?' For he knew that the chief priest had delivered him for envy. But the chief priest moved the people, that he should rather release Barabbas unto them. And Pilate answered and said unto them, 'What will ye then that I shall do unto him whom you call the king of the Jews?' And they cried out again, 'Crucify him.' Then Pilate said unto them, 'Why, what evil hath he done?' And they cried out the more exceedingly, 'Crucify him.' And so Pilate, willing to content the people, released Barabbas unto them and delivered Jesus when he had scourged him to be crucified." Now, it's 15 verses, and as far as taking sections in Mark, this is a pretty decent amount as far as taking 15 verses at once. But as you compare this to the other Gospels, again, Mark is given the bare bones of the account here. He's not filling out the details. And so let's go through and try to do it. I hope we can do it fairly quickly, but let's go through and kind of put the meat on the bones here and fill in the actual account of what all happens here as we look at some of the other Gospels. So if we start back in verse 1, just so we can kind of get the chronology of it, if you have your Bible, if you'll put your finger in Luke chapter 22, We're going to turn over there. We're also going to turn to John 18. Okay, so let's start back in verse 1. It says, "And straightway in the morning the chief priest held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and bound Jesus and carried him away and delivered him unto Pilate." Now, if you turn back to Luke 22, or turn over to Luke 22, you get a bigger picture as to what actually happened there. In Luke chapter 22, starting in verse 66, it says, "And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priest and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, Art thou the Christ? Tell us. And he said unto them, If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then said they all, Art thou then the Son of God? And he said unto them, Ye say that I am. And they said, What need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth." So if you remember, the last time we looked at the very end of Mark chapter 14, Christ had been arrested, he had been delivered, he had been questioned, he had been beat. And all the while, they're trying to get some legitimate reason to condemn him that they cannot find. You'll remember that they bring up all kinds of witnesses, but they can't get two witnesses to say the same thing. The chief priest, or the high priest, Caiaphas, finally asks him if he's the Christ. Jesus answers in the affirmative. So they're going to condemn Christ for blasphemy. When they bring him back that morning, they've got to get a condemnation, or they've got to get a conviction in the daylight. They can't go off of a conviction that they got in the middle of the night. So they bring him, and they start to ask him some questions. And then eventually they just come out with it and say, "Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of God?" And Jesus says, "Ye say that I am." Now, whenever we read that in the King James English, that's kind of an obscure answer. You kind of wonder what Jesus is saying. But Jesus is affirming, yes, he's saying, "You've said it. That's right. I am the Son of God. I am the Christ." And then right away it says, "What need we any further witnesses? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth." Jesus claims here to be the Christ, to be the Messiah, to be the one who would save Israel, to be the one who was prophesied of in the Old Testament, to be the one who would restore paradise lost to God's people, to be the one who would save God's people from their sins. They ask him that. He affirms that. But they've got a problem, and you'll see the problem here in a minute. The problem is, the Jews were no longer allowed to really carry out the Jewish law anymore. Used to in the Old Testament, if someone blasphemed, you could stone them on the spot, and that would be that. It wouldn't be a big deal. Rome had long took away the Jews' ability to kill anybody. The Jews, you know, as far as ceremonially, they could go by the law and they could do that, but Jewish law really meant nothing when it came to any real matters. And so there's a couple of reasons why the Jews want to get Christ to Pilate, but one of the reasons they want to get him to Pilate is because if they kill Christ outside of Pilate's jurisdiction, then they are charged as criminals. They're charged as murderers. Now the problem with this is Pilate could care less if Jesus claims to be the Messiah. That's not a threat to Rome, and you'll see that in a minute whenever we look to see how Christ explains what his claim is. The reason I tell you that is because it kind of helps to make sense out of why all this back and forth and why Pilate won't just condemn him, or why in the world would the Jews take Jesus to Pilate to begin with? And the answer to that question is because they had to. They had to. So Christ's answers in the affirmative. They say, what other witnesses do we need? We don't need any other witnesses. And so they bind him. This is where we pick back up in Mark 15. They bind him and they carried him away and they delivered him to Pilate. Now that's one verse in Mark 15. After they bind Jesus, that's where Luke 22, 66 through 71 comes in, where you actually get to see the trial. After they deliver him to Pilate at the end of verse 1 in Mark chapter 15, you can go to the Gospel of John chapter 18, which we're going to go and read about four verses, and you can see how that exchange goes. John chapter 18. He's condemned in the morning, he's bound, he's carried away, he's delivered to Pilate. And in John chapter 18, starting in verse 28, it says, "Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment, and it was early. And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they eat the Passover, but that they might eat the Passover. Pilate then went out unto them and said, What accusation bring ye against this man? They answered and said unto him, If he were not a malefactor, we would not have delivered him up unto thee. Then said Pilate unto them, Take ye him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, It is not lawful for us to put any man to death. And the sayings of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Then, starting in verse 33, he goes in and he and Jesus have their exchange, and he begins to question Jesus. But it just, the four verses there, 28 to 32, to just see what goes in and the little details that are there from the Jews taking Christ to Pilate. They go from Caiaphas' house. They go to the judgment hall. Jesus was not the only person on trial that day. Caiaphas was in the judgment hall because he was trying cases that day. He would have been. The Jews did not want to defile themselves, so they would not go in to where Pilate was, into that judgment hall, because they wanted to eat the Passover. Now, this may seem like a silly detail, but just keep that in mind because we're going to bring it up later. Let me put it another way. The people who are consumed with murdering an innocent man don't want to be defiled ceremonially by going into a pagan judgment hall. And so Pilate comes out to them. And this is what Pilate says. What do you want me to do? What accusation do you bring against this man? Well, that's a fair question for anybody that's a judge. You want to know whenever someone's being brought up on charges. Pretty much the question Pilate has is, what are the charges? You know what the Jews say? The Jews say, don't insult us by asking us for charges. We wouldn't have brought them to you if we didn't charge them with something. Kill them. They wouldn't defile themselves by going into a pagan judgment hall. But they wanted to kill a man without giving any charges. And what goes worse than that is they wanted to kill a man who they knew was innocent. And the scriptures here tell us they wanted to do it out of envy. And so you could pick back up in Mark chapter 15, verse 2. Pilate asked him, Art thou the king of the Jews? And he answered and said unto them, I'm sorry, he answered and said unto him, Thou sayest it. That is, you've said it. That's right. And the chief priest accused him of many things, but he answered nothing. Now this will be the last time we flip back over to Luke, and I won't flip back over there anymore. Let's go to Luke 23. That's right after what we just got finished reading. Now, you remember in Luke 22, they questioned, "Are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God?" And Jesus says, "Yes." Now, look in chapter 23. "And the whole multitude of them arose and led him unto Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king.'" Do you see that? When they're in their Jewish court, all they need is for Christ to say, "I'm the Messiah, I'm the Christ, I'm the Son of God," and there's blasphemy charges right there. They say, "What further witness do we need? We don't need any other further. We don't need any further witness. You're condemned because you claim to be the Messiah." But do you see, as soon as they get to Pilate and they start bringing up all these accusations, you notice they don't bring up the fact that he says he's the Messiah. They don't bring up the fact that he says he's the Son of God. They come out with an outright lie and say, "This man says you shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar. He's an enemy of Rome." They did that because, again, there would be no charge in Roman law for Jesus claiming to be the Son of God or the Messiah. Rome didn't care about that. Particularly whenever Pilate talks to Jesus and I don't know if interview is the word you want to use, but they had the one-on-one conversation, and Christ says, "My kingdom's not of this world. If I wanted to, I have charge of legions of angels, and they could come and fight for me right now if I wanted that to happen. But that's not the kind of kingdom that I have. That's not the kind of kingdom that I'm establishing." Pilate saw absolutely no threat politically from Jesus. The Jews knew that. And so what do? Well, they just grasp at whatever they can grasp at. You remember what happened whenever they asked him, "Is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar?" I mean, that was the unanswerable question. Nobody was going to be able to answer that question and neither not be accused of treason on one hand by saying, "Don't pay taxes to Caesar," or blasphemy on the other hand by saying, "Sure, pay taxes to Caesar, and the Jews would see that as almost an idolatrous type thing. And yet Jesus comes out with an answer, and he says, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and give to God the things that are God's." And so they come, and they just outright lie. Verse 3, "And Pilate asked him, saying, 'Art thou the King of the Jews?' And he answered him and said, 'Thou sayest it.' Then Pilate said to the chief priest and to the people, 'I find no fault in this man.' And they were the more fierce, saying, 'He stirreth up the people, teaching throughout all Jewry, beginning in Galilee, to this place.' When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked whether the man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time. And when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceeding glad, for he was desirous to see him of a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracle done by him. Then he questioned with him in many words, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. And the same day Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before they were at enmity between themselves." Here's what we get out of that, just as far as the account, what's happening in Jesus' trial before Pilate. Again, the Jews bring him with some trumped up charges. Pilate says, "What do you want me to do? Why do you want me to condemn this man? I don't find any fault at all." The Jews go into explaining a little bit about what they're accusing him of, and Pilate hears the word Galilee. Well, Herod was the governor over Galilee, so anything that happened in that jurisdiction, Herod could take care of. So Pilate says, "I don't have to mess with this case. Send him to Herod." So he goes, and Herod sees him. This is the same Herod, by the way, that beheaded John the Baptist. And it says that Herod was happy to see Jesus. He was excited about seeing him. He was hoping he would see a miracle. And the more he talked, the more he eventually found out that not only was he not going to see a miracle, he wasn't going to get a single word out of Jesus. And so he sends Jesus back to Pilate. When that happens, Pilate goes in and has another conversation with him. And then we can take the rest of the summation of that in Mark chapter 15, verse 4 down. So Pilate goes in, talks to Jesus again. He says, and this is not in Mark 15, but he says, "Do you not hear all these charges that they're bringing against you? Say something." And then it does say in Mark that Pilate marveled that Jesus wouldn't say a word. Now, I said earlier, Pilate would have been judging people all day long that day. He would have been judging cases the day before that day as well. Pilate was not stationed in Jerusalem. That's not where he lived. He lived in Caesarea, and he would come down during the feast days to make sure that there wasn't any chaos, there wasn't any outbreaks of anything, to keep the law, to keep the rule, I guess I should say. He was used to seeing criminals all the time. And as he looks at Jesus, and Jesus doesn't say a word about all these false accusations that are being thrown at him, he marvels. You remember in John, he says, "Do you not know that I have the power to let you go, and I have the power to crucify you?" Chances are, if Jesus would have just given a reasonable defense, if he would have just said a few words, he could have walked. It says Pilate marveled. He marveled. And then it tells us, starting in verse 6, "At that feast he released unto them one prisoner, whomsoever they desired. And there was one named Barabbas, which lay bound with them that had made insurrection with him, who had committed murder in the insurrection. And the multitude, crying aloud, began to desire him to do as he had ever done unto them. But Pilate answered them, saying, Will ye that I release unto you the King of the Jews? For he knew that the chief priests had delivered him for envy. But the chief priests moved the people, that he should rather release Barabbas unto them. And Pilate answered and said unto them, What will ye that I shall do to him whom you call the King of the Jews? And they cried out again, Crucify him. Then Pilate said unto them, Why? What evil hath he done? And they cried out the more exceedingly, Crucify him. And so Pilate, willing to content the people, released Barabbas unto them and delivered Jesus when he had scourged him to be crucified. I hope as we're going to Luke and John and trying to fill out some of the details that the picture, the bigger picture, is kind of ringing through, and it makes sense as far as what's going on here. We could go several different directions as far as our comments on the passage. What we do see ultimately here, not just at the end, but throughout the whole passage, is we see the events that are leading up to what we'll call the great exchange, and that is Christ's blood for our guilt. When you look and see what's pushing things into that direction, what's moving things into that direction, you see four things. We're going to look at four characters in this scene. Number one, we see envy. The chief priests and the scribes, the Pharisees, they all wanted to see Christ killed because they were envious of him. They were jealous of him. Number two, you see entertainment. Herod just wanted to be entertained. He had the power to let Christ go. If he would have let Christ go, he could have done that. Christ was in his jurisdiction. But Herod was happy to see Christ, and the reason he was happy to see him is because he wanted to be amused. He wanted to be entertained. Third, we see a people pleaser, and that would be Pontius Pilate. In order to content or to satisfy the people, he had him scourged. That is, just in a nutshell, he had the flesh torn off of his back and probably part of the front side of his body as well until he looked like a piece of meat that you hang up in a cooler somewhere. And then he had him nailed to a cross where he would suffocate to death if he were to die like a natural person would die on the cross. He did that to please the people. And then you see love. And you see that in the person of Jesus Christ, who is like a lamb before the slaughter, who, as he stands before his accusers, opens not his mouth. And the reason he doesn't open his mouth is not because he doesn't have anything to say. It's not because he couldn't have gotten off if he wanted to get off. But when you look at the silent Savior that's going through this rigmarole of injustice, he keeps his mouth shut, and it's motivated by one thing: love for his people. Isn't that incredible? Now we're going to look at that. That's just the outline. We're going to look at that a little further, but it's incredible whenever you look at that. Let's start with the chief priest back in Mark 15. It says Pilate knew this about them. In Mark 15, verse 10, it says, "For he knew that the chief priest had delivered him for envy." Pilate knew that. Mark tells us that. He knew that Christ was innocent. He knew that there were no legitimate charges there. He knew that they delivered Christ up to him because they were jealous of him. They were envious of him. Envy is just hate. Hatred towards someone because of a real or perceived prosperity or superiority. You see, what Jesus had that the scribes and religious leaders did not have, he had a bunch of different things. But what they were envious of was he had authority. He taught as one who had authority. And because of that, the people followed him. You see, he had their ear. You may say, well, that's a little simplistic. There's more to the story than that. And there is a little more to the story to that. But basically, the envy goes this way. If Christ has the authority, then the religious leaders don't have the authority anymore, because Christ constantly throughout his ministry is saying, this isn't right. You guys are whited sepulchers. You're full of dead men's bones. You're doing this for show. You're doing this to honor yourselves. This does not honor God. We could go back to the very early chapters of Mark, and Jesus goes in on a synagogue on a Sabbath day, and there's a man with a withered hand, and Christ heals that man. And what happens? The religious leaders conspire together to figure out how they can kill Christ. We could go to the tomb of Lazarus and watch Jesus as he raises Lazarus from the dead. A few days later, we could hear the chief priest conspiring. And what are they conspiring to do? They want to kill Christ, and they want to kill Lazarus as well. Why? Envy. It's out of envy. You see, they put on a good show. They looked like they were religious people, but inwardly, the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees, they hated God. They loved what they could get from God, but they were envious of the Son of God who came to speak the things which his Father had told him to speak, to do the things which his Father had told him to do, to reflect the full character of God in bodily form. They were envious of that. They were so full of envy that they were willing to break any commandment necessary to kill Christ. So we're not going to turn there, but if you're taking notes, you can write these down. Back in Matthew 27... verse 4, Judas is convicted. He goes to the chief priest and he says, "I have betrayed innocent blood. Take your money back. This man is innocent." You know what their response is? What's that to us? If we were to put that in modern day language, what they said was, "Who cares?" You see, Judas goes to him and says, "The man that you're getting ready to kill is innocent. I've betrayed innocent blood." And they say, Who cares? What do we care? We've been wanting to kill them. Now we've got what we need. Here we go. We said it earlier, but in John 18, they take Jesus to Pilate. They want Pilate to condemn him. And Pilate says, what charges do you bring? And they say, don't insult us with charges. We would have never brought this man to you if we didn't already have him charged as a criminal. Don't ask us, just kill him. You could go back to the Old Testament law and just see what God thought about an attitude like that toward life and death and even in a criminal case. We mentioned this earlier, but in Luke 22, as they condemn him among the Jews, they condemn him because he claims to be the Son of God. When they get in the face of Pilate, they will not defile themselves by going into a pagan judgment hall, but they will defile themselves by flat out lying, bearing false witness, and saying, this man says you should not pay taxes to Caesar. This guy's trying to, in other words, he's trying to overthrow Roman rule among the Jews. You see, the Jews were envious of Jesus. Not just of Jesus, but the Jews were envious of the message of Christ. You would read a couple other times in Acts, whenever Paul was preaching the gospel and the crowds were stirred, it says that the Jews, as they began to stir up or to bring charges, in Acts 13:45, it says they did it out of envy. In Acts 17:5, it says they did it out of envy. You see, as the Jews, the religious leaders, the chief priest, as they relate to Christ, they have an air of holiness about them, but the reality is they were full of jealousy and envy. They could have cared less about what God had to say to them. They just wanted to make sure that they appeared to be holy and honorable before the people. And as God made that more and more, exposed them more and more, what it drew out of those chief priests was a heart of envy, which led to, if you look in the New Testament, envy and malice and strife are all connected. And so it's an envy that produced a hatred for God. An envy that produced a hatred to God. This is things, by the way, these are the types of reactions that you tend to see on an elementary school playground whenever the new kid comes in, and maybe he's a little taller or maybe he's a little more skilled in something than somebody else, and you see little kids become envious as they, who were supposed to be the overseers of Israel, they were who's supposed to be the religious experts of the day, the holy men of the day, as they come and bring Christ for murder, they come to do it for the same reason. A little kid snatches a toy from someone else, or a little kid becomes jealous whenever there's another little kid around that may have something they want. Envy. They hated him for envy. Secondly, whenever you look at Herod, he goes from Pilate to Herod. Luke 23:8 is very clear that Herod was hoping to be entertained or amused by Christ. He wasn't mad. He had heard of Jesus. Matter of fact, in Jesus' ministry, he wanted to see Jesus, and Jesus wouldn't go see him. In Luke 23, it says that he had wanted to see him, and he was glad that he was there, hoping to see a miracle, hoping to be entertained, hoping to be amused. Now, as we look at these are obviously characteristics of people who are in the story here, but brothers and sisters, we've got to recognize also that these characteristics are found in the world we live in today and in the bodies and hearts that you live in today as well. So, for instance, those who would be aggressive toward Christianity, or even those who would relate to Christ the same way that the Pharisees did, out of envy, hatred out of envy. Well, you could look around and you could see that in several different world religions. You could also look around and see that in several different individuals who like Christianity as long as it lines out outwardly to the things that they like. But as soon as you move off from some legalistic standard, they just become envious, they become malicious, they become full of strife. Well, when you look at Herod, you can see the same thing. I mean, you don't have to look around very far or very long to figure out that there are many people like Herod, and that they get excited and even excitable about the thought of worshiping Christ as long as they're entertained or amused. But when that doesn't happen, just like Herod, they don't have any need for him anymore. When Herod found out he's not going to amuse us, he's not going to entertain us, it just sent him away. Brothers and sisters, we've got to make sure that we fight against the same type of attitude here, in both cases and even the third case down here. But the same type of attitude that Herod has as we come to the house of God, as you come to the Word of God. You know, Brother Isaac was talking this morning what he left off with as far as the difficulties that we have in Bible reading. I'm convinced that most people have difficulty in Bible reading not because they're unable to understand the Bible, but because they're unable to amuse themselves with the Bible, and so they get bored and just leave. You see, that's what Herod does here. It's not entertaining for him. He's not amused here. And so he sends him away. Herod had the power to declare him innocent. He had the power to send him home free. But instead of doing that, he just sends him right back to Pilate. And so thirdly, Pilate, this is where we'll spend the rest of our time outside of looking at the person of Christ. When he gets back to Pilate, we see Pilate trying to worm his way out as many times as he can, and then finally it says he wanted to please the people, so he scourges Jesus, he crucifies him. Why? Because he was a people pleaser. In other words, he feared man. He feared man. When you look at the Gospels here, it is absolutely clear Pilate did not want to condemn Jesus because he found no fault in him. He just said he's innocent. Not because Pilate was a noble person, not because he was a great man. He's looking at it like he would look at any other case, and he says, there's no fault here. I don't see any reason why we should do anything. He tries to get out of it. First he says, Jews, you can go just judge him according to your own law. The Jews refuse to do that. He examines him and he finds no fault. He sends him to Herod. He examines him again, and he finds no fault. He tries to pardon Jesus by giving the people the opportunity to choose him over Barabbas. After the people choose Barabbas, he has Jesus scourged, hoping that the people will be sympathetic as he brings Jesus back up, and they see what's left of his body there. And then finally, he goes down and symbolically washes his hands of the matter. And some outward symbol that Jesus' blood was not on his hands, but that didn't really diminish the guilt of Pilate, who was in a position of authority, who could have done something but didn't do something. And the reason that he didn't was because of the fear of man. You see, whenever you look at Pilate, and you got to read a little bit of history to kind of see what his circumstances were, what all surrounded Pilate's decision. Just from a human standpoint, some folks would say, I would have done the same thing. Pilate was the governor of Judah. He was a Roman, and he was someone who was politically driven. He wanted to move his way up the ladder politically. The fact that he was the governor of Judah was not a star in his crown. Nobody wanted to be the governor of Judah. The Jews were known for being difficult people. They were known for being stubborn. They were known for being just very difficult to try to govern. The governors were appointed by the Caesar at the time, the Roman emperor. It was Tiberius at this time. Pontius Pilate had a friend who was Tiberius' right-hand man for a while. He was in line to be the next emperor after Tiberius died. And he's the one that encouraged Tiberius to give Pontius Pilate a chance. Let him be the governor of Judah. So he does. As he comes to be the governor of Judah, there's some reforms that he's going to make. There are some things that he's going to change. Just to kind of give you a broad list of some of the things that happened that were influential on his decision to crucify Christ. As he goes to make some of these reforms and some of these changes, he upsets the Jews several times. Tiberius was sympathetic toward the Jews, and he did not want the governor of Judah to try to interrupt or disturb any of their religious convictions. The Jews knew that. And so when Pontius Pilate would do something that they would get upset about, they would go back and send someone to Tiberius, and Tiberius would send a letter to Pontius Pilate. Well, it's not like now. So it wasn't like he was going to get a letter that said, you know, Pontius, you're fired. Whenever you were removed because you upset the emperor, you were invited to commit suicide, or you were killed. You were invited to go to Rome, and you were killed. There were instances where you could be fired, I guess, but historically the conversations that go on between him and Tiberius through letters that they still have wasn't that kind of communication. So Pontius Pilate, when he gets to Jerusalem early on, sees that they have a horrible water supply. They need some water. And so he sets out and makes this new aqueduct that furnishes the city with plenty of water, but it's kind of expensive. So history tells us that he got together with the Jewish leaders and said, if we're going to do this thing, then we've got to take half of the funding out of the temple treasury. And the Jewish leaders reluctantly agreed to that if it would stay secret, because Jews didn't give the temple treasury to pagans to build anything. So he builds this aqueduct. Somehow word gets out that Pilate used half the money from the temple treasury, and there is an uproar in Jerusalem. That gets sent back to Tiberius. There was another time where Pilate brought in a band of Roman soldiers who had been honored and were given the honor of bearing some Roman seal. They were to come into Jerusalem, and they were going to be there for a little while. Well, any type of Roman seal or any type of pagan mark or figure or anything like that, the Jews always esteemed as idolatry. So these guys come in, they see the Roman seal on their armor, and the Jews throw a fit and say, get these guys out of Jerusalem. You are tarnishing Jerusalem with the seal on these people's armor. Well, Pontius Pilate was stubborn. He wasn't going to do it until finally he got word back from the Roman emperor that he better do it, and so he did. Third thing, Pontius Pilate decided to build a tower in Jerusalem. It was one that the Jews were excited about. It was called the Tiberium. He had built it in honor of Tiberius, the emperor. The Jews had no problem with that. Well, he goes to honor him a little more, and he just puts, I think it was 10 golden shields in this tower, and they say, in honor of Tiberius. The Jews throw a fit over idolatry. And Pontius Pilate digs his heels in. He's not going to take them down. He gets another letter from Tiberius. This time, tell him if he hears another word from any of the Jews about him, then he's going to invite him to come to Rome, and Pontius Pilate knows how that ends. Now, all that were bad enough. But several months before this happens with Christ, remember I told you Pontius Pilate had a friend who was second to the emperor. His name was Sejanus, Aulus Sejanus, I think is how you say it. It may not be. Tiberius was a paranoid emperor. Matter of fact, he was so paranoid, he spent very little time in Rome. He thought he was going to be assassinated from every side. He lived on this little island, and I can't remember now how many years it was, but there were maybe in the 30-year period that Tiberius did not go to Rome. His boat would go by it, but he couldn't get the nerve to go to Rome. He was so afraid of being assassinated. His right-hand man was there, and before this happens with Christ, several months, they uncover a plot that Sejanus is committing treason. He's got a plot to overthrow Tiberius and take over Rome. So, like any good Roman emperor, Sejanus is killed, his family is killed, and anybody politically that has anything to do with him at all is killed. Pontius Pilate's just waiting on the letter to come to him to say, come on to Rome, we invite you to commit suicide, or we're going to try you and kill you, or whatever. I say all that just to say, Pontius Pilate is a thin hair away from being killed. And the last thing he wants is for the Jews to go back to Tiberius and say, he's done it again. He won't let us keep our rule. He won't let us keep our laws. He's causing chaos in Jerusalem, because that's a death sentence for Pontius Pilate. And so what does he do? He fears the people. And he kills Christ. It was fear that was motivated just by saving his own skin. It was fear that was motivated out of just wanting to climb the ladder politically, which he would never do. The ironic thing about Pontius Pilate is that it was said in some of his earlier days that he had conversations that he was obsessed with political fame because he wanted his name to be remembered in Roman history. He wanted to be a great figure in Roman history. And the ironic thing about Pontius Pilate is that his name is the most famous Roman name, recognized Roman name, that the world knows today. You know why? He's known as the man who crucified Christ because he was a man pleaser. It's ironic, isn't it? In Matthew 10:28, Christ says, "Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." You see, Pontius Pilate had no fear of God, but he feared man. And while I'm not going to go into a bunch of applications here for you, I would just say, brothers and sisters, if we find ourselves giving over to men-pleasing, the fear of man, then we need to take Christ's words seriously in Matthew 10:28, not because we're afraid somebody's going to kill us, but because it is not fitting for a Christian to fear people more than they fear God. That's Pontius Pilate. Fourthly, this is the last one, we see the great exchange that takes place between Barabbas the murderer and the innocent Christ who is condemned. Now, if you just look at this exchange for a minute, Barabbas, so that was his last name. It was not his first name, it was his last name. Barabbas, son of Abba. You remember Simon Bar-Jonas, somebody bar somebody. You know, that's common throughout the New Testament. And so when you look at Barabbas, Bar Abba, his name literally means son of the father. When you see the exchange there, we see that Christ is condemned so that the son of the father could go free. Isn't that a beautiful picture? You realize that's what's happening, right? Christ is being condemned so that the sons of the father can go free. Look in 2 Corinthians 5:21. "For he hath made him to be sin for us who knew no sin, that we might be made the righteousness of God." This is the exchange that's taken place here. And while we look at it in a figurative sense, as far as Barabbas and Christ, this is what's actually going on. Christ, who knew no sin, goes as a lamb before the slaughter. He does not open his mouth. And he does that so that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. We already know that, and the question is why? Why would he do that? Why is he doing that? Look at Ephesians 2. The first part of Ephesians 2, Paul takes time and says, you need to remember who you were and where you came from. This is what you were in times past. You were a Gentile. You were dead. You walked or you lived according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. You fulfilled the desires of your flesh. By nature, you were the children of wrath. And then verse 4. "But God, who is rich in mercy, For his great love wherewith he loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace are you saved. And hath raised us up together and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace and his kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves, it's the gift of God. See what he says here? God, who is rich in mercy, for, he's getting to the motives here. Why would God do what God did? For his great love wherewith he loved us. Do you want to see the love of God on your behalf? Look at Christ in Mark 15. Look at the one who gives himself over to those who are envious, who allows himself to fall into the hands of one who just wants to use him for entertainment, who withholds himself from calling those legions of angels down who would fight for him as he's in the presence of one who is a man pleaser, one who says, I find no fault in this man, now go scourge him. I find no fault in this man, now go crucify him. Do you want to see the love of Christ? Well, it's the kind of love that we preached a message maybe a year ago about Christ set his face like flint toward Jerusalem. The love of Christ is this: Christ was willing to undergo humiliation and torture and death and separation from his Father on your behalf. Do you need confirmation that Christ loves his people? There is no greater confirmation than that. There's nothing greater that he could do. And so we would say, 1 John 4, here in his love, not that we loved God, but that God loved us and that he sent a son to be a propitiation for our sins. And so whenever you look at Christ in Mark 15, you really do see love in action, don't you? Husbands, we've got a lot to learn if we're going to love our wives the way Christ loved the church. You think you got to put up with a lot of stuff, husbands and wives both, with your spouses? Look at what Christ is putting up with here. Church member to church member, you think you have to put up with a lot of stuff? Look at what Christ is putting up with here. 2 Peter 2, or 1 Peter 2, tells us he did that to be an example for us. And so we see the great exchange, and in the midst of the great exchange, we see the love of God on our behalf. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful?
Thank you for listening to this message. Our prayer is that you've been blessed by the messages and the daily devotional blog on sermon audio from Ripley Primitive Baptist Church. We would love the opportunity to be of greater service to you and your walk with Christ. In other words, we would like to get to know you better. Do you have need of counsel, of a home church, or can we just pray for you? Please feel free to contact us by phone at 662-837-8590 or visit our website at www.ripleypbc.com.